Well, good evening, everybody, and welcome to Twisted Radio. I'm your host, Aaron Dakins. We are part of the Prepper Podcast Radio Network. Today is Thursday, March the 17th, 2011, and it's kind of been a crazy week since I talked to you last, hasn't it? Happy St. Paddy's to all of you out there, from one Irish prepper to any others out there. I'm going to go over a few things with you tonight, but I do have a guest scheduled, and I had him scheduled a couple weeks ago, but he's going to be here to talk about America in prophecy, and his name is Stephen Collins, but he's definitely a prepper just like the rest of us. I mean, he gets the whole picture and sees what's going on, so it ought to be a pretty good discussion, and we can touch on certainly things that are happening now. Our guest is here. I'm going to put a link up to his website. I had that up in the description, but I'm going to put it up for you guys to go right in there. He's written a lot of books. He's a published author. His name is Stephen Collins. He has an article there, too. It's on the right-hand side. If you scroll down, you will see it. Well, crud, now he's gone. Okay.
Hello.
Are you there?
Hello.
Oh, you're back.
Collins.
Okay. Okay, there
yeah,
you go. Hey, Stephen.
Yeah, I've been listening for 45 minutes.
He never told me you were on there. I'm sorry. I was hoping you would
yeah,
come
I call
before, Stephen.
No,
well,
I've been
okay,
waiting. I've just been waiting.
Here,
I called it. Yeah, I called in at 8 o'clock, and I've just been waiting for the queue.
Oh, okay. Sorry. Okay. Well, you're here now, and Clayton's not here, so you get the whole rest of the time. It is
all
yours
right
to run with it. Now, as I was telling you guys, when you go into his site, you scroll down on the right-hand side. There's a part that talks about American prophecy. That is, if you click on there, the read more or whatever it says on there, it will actually pull up a large excerpt from his book. He also has where you can download the e-book, right, Stephen, for $12.99?
That is correct.
Is that, yeah. The way he breaks this down, how many people have you talked to that are quote-unquote Christians or believers? Well, America's not mentioned in the Bible. Do you think God forgot the greatest nation that was ever going to be? I pretty much think he knew that, right, Stephen?
Absolutely. And the United States is very clearly in the Bible. It's just obviously not called the United States of America. You have to understand the terms that the Bible uses for the Latter-day people in order to recognize it. And I might mention to your listeners that there will only be time to give a broad brush picture of the high points on this subject tonight. But if they would like to, that $12.99 book is over 600 pages chock full of information combining the narrative and prophetic information of the Bible with the secular historical accounts of the Greeks, Romans, Persians, and others to show that the Bible has traced the 10 tribes of Israel very correctly with its prophecies about them. I mean, Genesis 49 and Revelation 7 prophesy all the tribes of Israel are going to be here among the nations in the latter days. And they are identifiable. Genesis 49 gives us clues to identify them. And for Americans, when your listeners read that article, the United States of America in Bible Prophecy, which is free, it's a 19-page article, but that'll be eye-popping to people to see that the United States is mentioned in the Bible. In fact, if the United States was mentioned. Yeah, let me give your listeners a quiz here a little bit. If there was a quiz question that in the Bible there was a nation that in the latter days it was prophesied to be a strong and mighty nation, would be very prosperous, it would be known as a melting pot nation, it'd be known as a nation from sea to shining sea, from east to west, it'll have an Anglo-Saxon origin, the number 13 would be conspicuous in its origins and symbolism, and that it would have a special relationship with an allied company or commonwealth of nations that also had a Saxon origin in a common language and culture, which language do you think, or which nation do you think it would be describing? Yeah, obviously, the United States of America, but all of those clues are answered in the Bible, and they're all found about a nation mentioned in the latter days. It's going to have a prominent role. And I encourage your listeners to read that. I will mention that that ebook, The Lost Ten Tribes of Israel Found, was out as a printed book for some time, a number of years. It went through four printings, and then it was out of print for a while, but it's just within literally the last few weeks been resurrected as an ebook. so that people can download it at half the price of the original printed book, and they can have all the information there readable, and that would give people an eye-opening view of what's happening in the world. As you said in your discussions earlier, there's so much happening in the world right now with Libya, Japan, the Middle East, et cetera, the food issues, the inflation issues, the looming collapse of the dollar. We definitely are in the latter days. And when they read that article or when they read the book The Lost Ten Tribes of Israel Found, they will be looking at world history on up into our modern times from a biblical perspective. What we're getting in our history textbooks for many, many generations has been a Greco-Roman perspective of the world history. And, in fact, the Israelite perspective, the biblical perspective on world history is very different than the Greco-Roman, because the Israelite empires were frequently the enemies of the Roman empires or the Greeks, and were fighting wars with them. But I did want to also mention to you that since you were having your prepper comments, I do have a prepper article at my website, which is Should Christians Prepare for Future Hard Times? And with your permission, I'll just give a couple comments on that.
Please do. Yeah, because people fight this all the time, Steve, and this is one of the biggest battles that preppers have, is trying to get people get that comment, well, we're going to be raptured out of here. I don't worry about it.
See, this is the complacent perspective that so many Americans have, is that, oh, nothing bad is ever going to happen here. And I'll get into that in some of this program yet tonight. But there's a proverb that says, you know, the prudent man sees the danger afar off and prepares for it. The Bible tells us that if we can see a time of danger ahead, we should take some action. But there is a Christian attitude there that is widespread, which says, oh, we'll just let God take care of us. We'll just have faith, and God will take care of us. And, yeah. But that attitude is not the correct one to have in the latter days.
Okay.
The Bible has a number of examples where when God gives people advance warnings of danger to come, he expects them to act on his warnings. It's a lack of faith not to. For example, Noah, he was warned there was going to be a global catastrophe and a flood. If he had just sat back and said, oh, God will take care of us, I don't need to build that ark, the human race would have been wiped out. God, he was preserved with his family because he took action and prepared. Joseph, when he was warned there would be seven very dry and famine years after seven prosperous years, he stored up food like you wouldn't believe. The Bible says he couldn't even number the amount of wheat and everything that he had stored. So he was one of the world's greatest preppers, was Joseph.
Yeah, amen.
And because he prepped, nations survived because of his actions. That's another example where God gave an advance warning to Pharaoh in that dream that really hard times were coming. So when God tells us this, we should take action. Now, we as Christians are living in the latter days. I think many of your listeners would concur with that.
Yeah.
I think that's very provable. I've got an article on my website also stating, are we living in the latter days? And you can find that at the Articles tab at my website, which is www.stephenmcollins.com, Stephen with a V. And the articles there are accessible on a wide variety of topics. But the latter days is a time when we're warned in the Scriptures of many, many evil things to happen. I mean, Revelation 6 talks about famines. Matthew 24, Christ warns in his Olivet prophecy about famines. Certainly earthquakes, the tsunamis that we had in the Indian Ocean and Japan, those fit in the prophecies with Luke 21, I think it's verse 35, where it talks about the oceans or the seas and the waves roaring. Well, that would be like hurricanes like Katrina or tsunamis, like in the Indian Ocean and now just in Japan.
Now, Stephen, where do you think in prophecy, where do you think, what part of the end days do you think we're in now? Because there's so many different people have so many different takes on this. What's your take on where we are now? Are we in any of the judgments, bowls, trumpets? You know, where do you think we fit in right now?
Well, rather than getting lost in terminologies, which some people define differently, I'll just say I think we're deeper into the latter days than most Christians realize. The parable of the ten virgins warns us that in the latter days, whether believers had a lot of oil in their lamps or very little, all of them are going to be surprised that Jesus Christ, the Savior, comes a lot sooner than any of them expect. So even the ones that have a lot of oil, you know, symbolic of God's Spirit, they're in a good relationship with the Lord. But even those people are going to be amazed that Christ comes, the bridegroom, comes a whole lot earlier than they expected. They all think that they have lots more time, and they don't. And God says he's going to make a swift work of things at the end. And where I think we're at right now, in terms of what the next big prophetic event would be, is in Revelation 17 and 18. It talks about the collapse of a global world system called Babylon the Great. And it's clearly a global system. Revelation 18:3 describes that this Babylon the Great system that falls is going to be an alliance, an unholy one, of the kings of the earth. In other words, that's the political rulers. And they're all in bed with the merchants of the earth. That's a very good prophetic term for global multinational corporations, the merchants of the earth. You know, the earth is their whole marketplace. They're not national companies anymore. They're multinational, global companies.
Right.
But it clearly shows that they're there for their mutual aggrandizement, and they live very lucratively and corruptly at the expense of others. But this Babylon the Great system is going to collapse, and it's going to collapse hard. It says in Revelation 17 that this Babylon the Great system is also likened with the term the Great Whore that has ridden the nations for a long time. But it says a group of seven heads and ten horns are going to make war against this global international system, and they're going to tear it down. It says they're going to eat her flesh and burn her with fire. That sounds like a pretty violent overthrow.
Yeah.
And so when you look at our global international economy right now, clearly the U.S. dollar is the global reserve currency. And so that's the lifeblood of the petrodollar market and world commerce. The Federal Reserve Board controls the U.S. dollar supply, so they're the beating heart of the global reserve, the global economy that we have right now. So really, I see the U.S. Federal Reserve Board as the beating heart of Babylon the Great. The dollar is the lifeblood system, and we're in terrible danger. I mean, with the qualitative easing and the debasing of our dollar system, we're really at the precipice of other nations losing all faith in the United States' ability to function as the global reserve currency. Other nations are making bilateral agreements to squeeze the dollar out of their markets.
Mm-hmm.
Even a NATO nation like Turkey made an agreement with China that they won't bother using the dollar anymore
in
international trade. They're going to use their own local currencies. And there is plenty of rumor on the Internet, and I don't think it's all rumor. I think it's very real things that are happening, is that there will be either one or a group of regional new currencies that will be either gold or commodity-backed currencies. The Chinese, the Russians, the Gulf Arab states, possibly a Nordic or Central Euro, will have a gold component to it. I mean, Angela Merkel, the Prime Minister of Germany, has been ferocious in her criticism of Ben Bernanke and the U.S. Federal Reserve Board. Other nations are, too. They're blaming the United States for importing the inflation into their nations. China has encouraged all of its citizens to stock up on gold and silver. They've also added silver and platinum as part of their strategic gold to their strategic gold reserves. So China is working very fast to get suck in as much gold and silver into their nation that they can in the world markets. This really looks like they have every intention of launching a gold-backed yuan or a precious metals-backed yuan as a way of dethroning the dollar. And if our dollar is overthrown as the global reserve currency, the USA could be in dire shape very quickly because we make very little in the United States. If the dollar is no longer trustworthy internationally, what are people going to sell us? I mean, will they make us pay in gold?
What are we going to pay for it with? That's the question, yeah.
That's a very good question. We'll have to barter something. For example, China is our biggest creditor, but many other nations are creditors as well. They'll say, well, we'll sell you some cheap shirts and tennis shoes and oil, but you're going to have to give us title to all that foreclosed real estate that your banks
are doing that with China, yeah.
Yeah, or whether
people
you're
don't
have
understand
to give
that if we lose the status, our dollar's worth nothing, and that is one of those scenarios, guys, where it could literally crash overnight. I mean,
yes,
literally. You go to bed, everything's floating along. You wake up the next morning, and it's just done. That's one of the scarier scenarios that it happens that fast. I'm ready to get the show on the road, Stephen, you know, as far as just get this all done. On the one hand, because the slow boil, it's taxing to the old nerves, you know. But yet,
well,
but then the other alternative is crash it overnight, and then it's Katie bar the door.
I know it. Now, on my website, I also have blogs that I have regular posts several a week that follow the prophetic march of events. And I urge listeners to follow those, too, because I have a network of listeners or contributors to my website that feed me information from around the world, that feed me information that is not put on our national media here, that they tell me, you Americans have no clue what a precipice you're on, you know, what trouble you're in. And so some of the links that I will be able, that I report on these blogs, you won't find in the anywhere near the establishment media in the United States. But back to the prepping attitude, we believers are told in the latter days very hard times are coming. So we're in a position like Noah and Joseph. We've been warned that bad times are coming. We need to prepare as an act of faith in believing that God is telling us the truth. And,
why would he tell us all this if he didn't want us to prepare?
Absolutely.
That's what I can't get rid of people. Duh. He says
yeah,
to
like,
watch
like
for these signs so you know when the time is coming.
Yeah, so that we won't be surprised. And like the Proverbs,
you know, are we
has
supposed
biblical...
to sit around and sing Kumbaya or what? I don't think that's what he wants.
No, that's just that's being a foolish virgin, is just to sit around and mindlessly think God's going to do everything for you. With your permission, I'll talk about some of the aspects of the 10 tribes of Israel, because this has a huge impact on America.
Stephen, you talk about whatever you want to talk about, because you know me, I'm a true Israelite, so, you know,
yeah, this,
talk about whatever you want.
One of the first things I want to clarify is the difference in the Bible between the terms Judah and Israel, because it's widely assumed in the modern Christian world that they're synonyms, and they're not. The terms Judah and Israel go back to the ancient kingdom of Israel, even under King David and Solomon, when they were all the tribes of Israel were under one king. Judah and Israel were reckoned as separate administrative units. There wasn't that much cohesion between them. And after the division of the two kingdoms, the nation into two kingdoms, after the death of Solomon, within a few years, there was a civil war, and they split. Jeroboam became the king of the northern 10 tribes, and Rehoboam, Solomon's son, was king of the smaller kingdom of Judah that still had Jerusalem as a capital. From then on, Judah became known as the Jews, and the 10 tribes of Israel, who were not at all Jewish, became known as the Israelites. And they were often at war with each other. There's accounts in the Bible where it talks about the Israelites being at war against the Jews, which is, you know, counterintuitive to many Christian thinkers. But all of the tribes of Israel eventually did go into exile for their sins from the promised land, and they took separate migration routes at separate times. Now, the term Judah, from the time of the division of the kingdoms, was always the name of the Jews, or Judah and their affiliated tribes, which was Levi and Benjamin at that time. The 10 tribes of Israel to the north were led by Ephraim and Manasseh. And I'll give a little bit of a sidebar on that, because in Genesis 48 and 49, the Bible gives us phenomenal clues about the latter days. In Genesis 49:1, it mentions that this is a latter-day prophecy, and originally the manuscripts, of course, weren't divided into chapters and verses. This was a continual scroll. And Genesis 48 shows that there was a very private blessing ceremony where the man named Jacob, whose name had been changed to Israel, blessed his grandsons, Ephraim and Manasseh, who were the sons of Joseph. Jacob was the man who had 12 sons who founded the 12 tribes of Israel.
Right.
Joseph was one of those 12. But he had two sons, Ephraim and Manasseh, and Joseph was given a double portion in Israel. So Ephraim and Manasseh each became a separate tribe. Now, during that blessing ceremony, Jacob put his hand over the right hand of Ephraim, the younger son, and his left hand over the head of Manasseh, the older son. Joseph wasn't pleased because he wanted to reverse it, because the right hand should go on the oldest son according to the normal blessing ceremony. But Jacob said, no, this is of God, I'm going to do it this way. But since the right hand was on Ephraim's head, Ephraim was really the 12th tribe of Israel and got Joseph's portion. But Manasseh was grandfathered in, literally, by grandfather Jacob as a 13th tribe of Israel that would be equal with one of the other tribes. So from then on, there were 13 tribes. But Ephraim and Manasseh in Genesis 48 are prophesied that in the latter days, Manasseh was going to be a single great nation. Ephraim, the brother tribe, was going to be a company, a fullness, or a multitude, or if we can use a modern term, a commonwealth of nations. And Genesis 21:12 gave the clue that the birthright seed, which Ephraim and Manasseh were, was going to be perpetually known by the name of Isaac. And in Genesis 48, Jacob repeats this. He says, let the name of Isaac and my name, which was Israel, when he was speaking, be on Ephraim and Manasseh. So the term Israel, or a name derived from the term Isaac, will primarily denote the tribes of Ephraim and Manasseh. They got the best blessings of any of the tribes of Israel. Then after they were blessed, then the other tribes of Israel, including Judah, the forefathers of the Jews, came in, and they had their separate blessings and prophecies about them in the latter days. Now, when the tribes split, it's a common Christian misconception that the 10 tribes of Israel got lost or died out or God forsook them. That's totally untrue, and if your listeners have Bibles, they can follow along or just write these scriptures down and check it out on their own. But in Hosea 1:10, Hosea 1, it is a chapter where Hosea the prophet is proclaiming that Israel is going to go into captivity or into exile for their sins. But verse 10 says that even though they were going to all be exiled, God was going to vastly increase their population after he sent them into exile. They were going to be much, much huger nations in their exile than they ever were in the promised land. He was going to make them like the sand of the sea or the stars of the heavens, which goes back to one of the Abrahamic blessings in the book of Genesis. 100 years after the 10 tribes went into captivity, the prophet Jeremiah was told by God to send a message to them in Jeremiah 3:12. And he says, send a message to those 10 tribes. He says, and send it to the north. That's very important because if you look straight north of Jerusalem on a map, you come up to the Black Sea region. If all of the Israelites had been taken into captivity to Assyria, God would have told them to send the message to the east, because that's where Assyria was. But the majority of the tribes of Israel did not go into captivity. Neither the Bible nor Assyrian records claim any more than about a third of the tribes went into captivity. The rest of them voluntarily left because they saw the handwriting on the wall, and they did not want to go into Assyrian slavery. So Israel had a very extensive network of colonies in Spain, in Carthage, in the British Isles, in the Black Sea. So their populations fled and fanned out all over the place to escape the Assyrians. The book of Daniel confirms this, where Daniel is praying for the forgiveness of God for Israel and Judah, and he names them as separate entities. But he talks about Israel in verse 7 of chapter Daniel 9, and he talks about Israel that is near, or Israel that is afar off in all the countries where you have driven them. So it's clear that the 10 tribes of Israel had scattered in many different directions and among many different nations at that particular time. The Israelites that were near were the ones that did go into an Assyrian captivity that later became a Persian captivity. Now, Isaiah 14:2 is a prophecy that Christians read right over too, but there it says that the 10 tribes of Israel will eventually rise to rule over the kingdoms that took them captive. Okay. Now, the kingdoms that took them captive were Assyria and Babylon and the Medo-Persians, because the inhabitants of Samaria, for example, were brought into the cities of the Medes. So Assyria, Babylon, and Medo-Persia were the captor nations. But later on, an Israelite empire named Parthia rose and ruled over Assyria, Babylon, and all the Medo-Persians. So God fulfilled that prophecy, and the Parthians were the source of the wise men and magi who came and visited and gave gifts of gold, frankincense, and myrrh to the Christ child. I have all of this detailed in my books. In Jeremiah 51:5, God flatly says he has not forsaken the 10 tribes of Israel, and that was about 125 years after he sent them into exile. even then, he says, I haven't forsaken them. And of course he hasn't, because he promised to make them huge, huge nations after they were sent into captivity. Josephus, a Jewish historian in the first century A.D., wrote that in his lifetime, that, you know, he was a contemporary of Jesus Christ, he wrote that the 10 tribes in his lifetime were too numerous to count, and that they were located beyond Euphrates. Now,
right.
That's a key phrase, because in his time, the Euphrates River was the border between the Roman Empire and the Israelite-dominated empire of Parthia. And it had been for a very long time. So the euphemism beyond Euphrates meant in Parthia. And all of his readers would have known that. Just like if we were all sitting in Texas, you and I and your listeners, and we all said, well, let's go across the Rio Grande this weekend and have a vacation. Everyone would understand that's a euphemism for in Mexico. In Josephus's time, beyond Euphrates meant in Parthia. But when the Israelites scattered into exile, that name of Isaac stayed on them. The Greeks called it called the Scythians, who were up by the Black Sea. These were related tribes to the Parthians. They called them the Sacae, S-A-C-A-E. But there you have Sacae, the name of Isaac. Ancient languages really didn't write the vowels, just the consonants. So that's the root word of the name Isaac. The Persians called these people the Saka, S-A-K-A. There they used a K instead of a C.
Mm-hmm.
But that had a more of an Eastern Hebraic pronunciation, mm-hmm. were like Itzhak or Saka, like there was an Itzhak Rabin, who was prime minister of Israel. There you had more of a K sound. Now, when these people had an empire for about a half a millennium, the Parthians did, and the Scythians even longer. The Scythians knocked the stuffings out of the Persian Empire twice, and the Parthians regularly defeated the Roman Empire in warfare. The Roman and Greek historians wrote a great deal about these people. In fact, Caesar Augustus made a decree that Parthia was too strong for Romans for the Roman army to fight, as the Crassus and Mark Antony had led invasions of Parthia and been utterly crushed. Our modern readers think Rome was the great only superpower. In fact, Parthia was a superpower that was totally equal to Rome in the ancient world, and it was led by the 10 tribes of Israel. Some of the Parthian cities had clearly Israelite names. One of them was Samariana, which was named after Samaria, the capital of the 10 tribes. One of their early capitals was named Asak, A-S-A-A-K in English, but that's clearly the name of Isaac. Another Parthian city was Gaza, G-A-Z-A, the exact name of the old Philistine city. Obviously, when the Israelites were taken captive, Philistines and others were taken captive too, and so you had these Israelites and Philistine names surfacing in the Parthian Empire. And The Israelites grew into massive kingdoms and empires in their time of exile. And when they fell, it was around 227 A.D., when the Persians revolted and destroyed the Parthian Empire and drove the Parthians out of Asia. Now, there was one Parthian province that stayed free. That was Armenia in the Caucasus Mountains.
Okay.
So just as if in the United States we were invaded in a Red Dawn scenario, and say Texas or Montana, whatever state stayed free, that would be an immediate magnet for everybody to flee to maintain the freedom. Well, Armenia was the free province of Parthia that kept Parthian rulers and kings, so the Parthians fled in that direction. Well, that's a very mountainous region, the Caucasus, so they couldn't stay there. There was far too many millions of them, so they just passed through the Caucasus Mountains on their way up to the Black Sea region, and from there on into Europe. Now, in the 3rd century AD, Parthia fell. In the 3rd century AD, Rome and Europe began to be invaded by all kinds of Caucasians that came out of Asia into Europe. The term Caucasian isn't technically a racial term. It's really a historic term that describes where these tribes coming into Europe that inundated the Roman Empire came from, and they came through the Caucasus Mountains region, so they're called Caucasians. But isn't it interesting that our secular historical accounts, they talk about the millions and millions and millions of Germans and Goths and Anglo-Saxons and Vandals, the Franks and others that poured into Europe for centuries out of Asia, and they never ask the obvious question, gee, where did they come from? How come there's all millions and millions of Semitic white people Caucasians pouring out of Asia into Europe in numbers too numerous to even count, so many that they crushed the Roman Empire and replaced it and formed the population basis of the modern European nations. But what triggered the event was the fall of Parthia and the migration of its millions of people along with their related Scythian tribes into Europe. Now, the Romans did not pronounce the name of Isaac the same way that the Greeks or the Romans did. The Greeks or the Persians. Like the Greeks had a S-A-C, which is more like preserving the root word of sack, Isaac.
Okay.
But the Romans turned that C into an X, so they called them the Saxons. Instead of the Sakans, they called them the Saxons.
Okay.
And while these nations were in Asia, in Scythia or Parthia, they had such names as the Gothi, the Germanii, the Kermans, the Sakans, the Jats. When they poured into Europe, they became known as the Germans, the Saxons, the Jutes, the Goths. And so their names of the Scythians and Parthians stayed with them pretty obviously as they poured into Europe.
Right.
So these nations eventually fought the Romans, and then they fought among themselves and formed the population basis of modern European nations. And these were the Israelite 10 tribes that migrated into Europe. And then they eventually spread abroad to form the nations of the United States, Canada, Australia, and New Zealand, the Anglo-Saxon nations. And the United States rose to become the single great Anglo-Saxon nation that was prophesied in Genesis 48 to be in existence in the latter days. And the British Empire founded a multitude of nations, which was Canada, Australia, New Zealand, and Great Britain, they were all Anglo-Saxon, English-speaking, brother nations with a special relationship. This was prophesied in Genesis 48 and 49 for Ephraim and Manasseh. So the United States is really Manasseh, and the British Empire is Ephraim. My book has deep explanations of this and well-documented with chapter endnotes and full bibliographies so people can duplicate the research. But there's other reasons, too, that also point to the United States as Manasseh. When the nation of Israel was founded in 1948, Newsweek magazine had an article about two or three years ago, that President Harry Truman was deeply involved and became a supporter of the founding of the Jewish state. But when the Jews, named their nation Israel, Truman and his deputy Clark Clifford were amazed. They thought that they would name themselves Judah or Judea. We had a president of the United States, Harry Truman, that was knowledgeable enough on the Bible that he knew the Jews weren't the Israelites, that that was a separate entity, that the Israelites
right.
were the 10 tribes, not Judah, that they weren't Jews. So he was amazed they named themselves after the old land of Israel rather than Judah, who they really were. So can you imagine how different our Christian philosophy and perspectives would be now if there wasn't any nation in the world named Israel? If the Jews had named themselves Judea or Judah, there wouldn't be any nation on the map named Israel, and all these prophecies about Israel in the latter days would have to be searched and investigated to find out, wow, who is this nation Israel? But there's been a great deception, because Judah is really the Jewish people, and the tribes of Israel are the European nations and the Anglo-Saxon nations. Now, another factor about Israel, and this really should be riveting and give a very good reason for people to be in a prepping attitude, is Ezekiel 38 and 39 is a very prominent prophecy about the latter days, and the Gog-Magog alliance is recognized by many, many Christian evangelists and people who follow prophecy as Russia, China, Iran, and their allies. And it's clearly a latter-day prophecy because it says so. But it says that the nations that they're going to attack is Israel, or the house of Israel, as it says in Ezekiel 39. The house of Israel has to bury the bodies or bury the bones for 7 months if there's just so many dead bodies after this World War III. But
right.
the nations that are attacked in Ezekiel 38 and 39 is not Judah. It's not the Jews. I respectfully challenge your listeners to look up that 38 and 39th chapter. You won't find the name Judah anywhere in there, because the Jews have nothing to do with that prophecy. It's not about them. In Zephaniah 2, when God had a prophecy about the founding of the promise that there would be a Jewish state in the Mideast in the latter days, he uses the term Judah. Then there he doesn't use the term Israel at all. He uses Judah because he's talking about the Jews. But in Ezekiel 38 and 39, he's talking about Israel. This means the 10 tribes, and especially Ephraim and Manasseh, the Anglo-Saxon nation. So the target nations of Russia, China, and Iran that will be invaded will be the United States, will be Britain, Canada, Australia, New Zealand, and the Scandinavian and European nations, which are the other tribes of Israel, as well as their worldwide allies. And this fits perfectly what's taking shape. China is building its military very quickly to try to destroy the United States in a war. They're developing supersonic cruise missiles, ICBMs, which can specifically target aircraft carriers, etc., where China is planning a war on the United States. Russia is rebuilding its military now. Iran hates us. We're called the Great Satan to them. These nations have a tremendous desire to see us destroyed. And it also says in Ezekiel 38, that it's in verse 8, I believe, that it's a nation that is gathered out of many nations that's attacked, this nation of Israel. Well, it's, the United States has long been known as a melting pot nation because it was formed from people being drawn from many nations. So that fits also the United States' heritage. In Ezekiel 38, it also has a verse where it says that this same war, this same invasion has been talked about in previous parts of the Bible. And Ezekiel prophesied in perhaps the 6th or 5th century B.C. So there's prophecies in the Bible older than that that discuss this. One of them is Joel 2, where it also talks about an invasion of Israel in the latter days from which God rescues them. And that's the same theme of Ezekiel 38, which says the nations of Israel will be attacked in the latter days, and God rescues them. But there's two other common factors. One is in Ezekiel 38, it makes very clear that the nations of Israel, Ephraim and Manasseh, the U.S. and Britain and their allies, will be attacked from out of the north. Joel 2 says that a northern army will be attacking Israel in the latter days. So these are very parallel prophecies. And in Joel 2, it mentions that when God does intervene, it talks about the destruction of the invading enemy forces at his hand, but it talks about they will be driven to between an eastern and a western sea, or it talks about a western and an uttermost sea, I believe, but that's obviously east and west. So what nation is a melting pot nation that has the name of Isaac or the Saxon name on it that also is a land from sea to shining sea, from east to west? The United States. That fits us. There's another huge clue for the United States. Remember in Genesis 48 when Jacob, the man Israel, blessed Ephraim and Manasseh as the birthright tribes who had received the biggest blessings among the Israelite descendants, and he said that, you know, let my name be named on them. But Ephraim had the right hand, so that was really the 12th son position that Joseph would ordinarily have had. But when Manasseh had the left hand put on his head, and he became a separate tribe too in Israel, Manasseh became the 13th tribe of Israel. Before, there was only 12. And when Manasseh became 13, that number was fixed on Manasseh. What nation in the modern world has 13, that number stamped on them? What nation started with 13 colonies, had its flag with 13 stars and 13 stripes, which on its national crest of the United States has 13 stamped all over it? There, on that national crest, there's 13 bars on the shield. It has 13 stars, 13 arrows in a talon, 13 leaves on the olive branch. There's even 13 letters in the motto, E Pluribus Unum. So the number 13, Manasseh's number, is stamped on the United States. And what I'm saying is not actually just my own view. I have an Israeli-Jewish colleague, Yair Davidi is his name. I visited him and met with he and other rabbis in Jerusalem in the year 2000, where he has written books from a Jewish perspective on Jewish sources, and he comes to the same conclusions as me on the United States and Britain being Ephraim and Manasseh. And he's trying to wake up the Jewish people to realize that, hey, the United States and the British and many European and Scandinavian nations, they're our lost brothers from the 10 tribes of Israel, and I'm trying to do the same from here. It would probably surprise your listeners to know that in 1855, just before the Civil War, there was a pastor named Pitts who gave a message to a joint session of the Congress. A joint session, you know, that really only happens when the presidents speak to them now, but they had a pastor who was presenting a revolutionary doctrine which the Congress in 1855 thought was so important that all the congressmen should hear it, and they had a joint session for 2 days to hear this pastor preach. And what he was telling them was that the United States was descended from Israel. It was from the 10 tribes of Israel.
Okay.
And that we were the regathered Zion and the nation of Israel. And so this has been known before. Can you imagine somebody giving this message to our Congress today?
Oh, well, they'd probably be stoned and thrown out, but anyway.
Well, they did. They would be, unless they have angels on either side that would strike dead anybody that would dare to do that. Who knows, that might happen someday when the two witnesses come on the scene, but that's a whole different story. But I'm hoping I'm encouraging your reader, your listeners to order that book, The Lost 10 Tribes of Israel, found on my website for a mere $12.99. That's just a couple of cappuccinos. And you can buy it online with a credit card. And for those who choose not to do business on the Internet, there's some people that don't want to do business on the Internet, they can send me a check for $12.99. And if they have an email address, I'll mail them the link so they can receive them that way. Some people have already done that. I'll give my postal address, which is Stephen Collins, P.O. Box 88735, Sioux Falls, South Dakota, 57109-8735. I take either a money order or a personal check. And then but be sure to give me your email address so I can send you the link, because it's only available right now as an e-book. But that way it can be distributed to anyone. And the importance of realizing who Israel is in the world today is so eye-opening. It would revolutionize the Christian world if we could understand that we were the house, we are Israel, and we're the bullseye of Ezekiel 38 and 39.
It's like you said, it's the greatest deception that's ever been perpetrated on man, because we are Israel. So if you understand that, the Bible makes a whole lot more sense, especially in the end days and prophecy. And that's why I had you on. That's why I've been researching this myself for a while, because I wanted to know who I was. Why do I feel the way I do? But it also kind of lets you know that you do, the Israelites, us, the house of Jacob, we will have special jobs, so to speak, Stephen, I think, things that we're going to be called upon to do for the Father. And I think that's why a lot of us are called to prepare. But that's just my own weird thoughts that I have. But we do have a caller, Stephen. You want to go ahead and take him?
I'll go right in.
Okay. Dave from Maryland, come on in.
Yes, good evening, Aaron, Steve.
Hey there.
I have a question. Steve, I'm 100% behind everything you're talking about tonight. You are speaking the truth. I've done a little studying on this myself. And in the past, I've heard David J. Smith touch on this, you know, Newswatch Magazine, touch on this a little bit. But I have a question here that I have confronted many of pastors with, and I've never got a straight answer. Perhaps you could help me. Where did the black nations come from, the black people?
They came from the descendants of Ham. I can give you a real straight answer on that.
Okay, let me ask you the question. Well, go ahead. I'm sorry. I'm sorry to interrupt you. Go ahead.
Okay, and do a follow-up if I'm not clear afterwards. But after the flood, Noah's family was all that was left. It said everything else that breathed on the face of the earth died. And so Noah and his wife and his 3 sons and their 3 wives were the only 8 souls that survived. There were no other serpent seed, and there were no other individuals who survived a regional flood. This was an entire global flood. And otherwise there would have been no need for God to have Noah build an ark. He could have just had him migrate to a different part of the earth. But when they came out of the ark, those 8 souls, you know, were the progenitors of all the modern races. Now, Shem, Ham, and Japheth are the fathers of all of the races that we have on the world today. By and large, Japheth, the nations of Japheth, are descended today into the Oriental nations in Asia. The descendants of Shem, the Bible tells us, included all of the children of Abraham, and that includes the Israelites, it includes the Ishmaelites, which are the Arabs, as they will proclaim to you quite openly today, and they're right, they are the descendants of Ishmael. It includes Esau, it includes Abraham, after Sarah died, he had a wife named Keturah who had a whole bunch of other sons, and he had concubines beside who had a whole bunch of other sons that aren't even named. So Abraham has a lot of he has fathered many nations, which in Genesis he was told to do. They're all Semitic nations from Shem. However, the Abraham seed are just the dominant part of the seed of Shem. The Assyrians, the Aramaeans, the Elamites, these were also from Shem. And so not all Semitic nations are Israelite. However, the descendants of Ham included the nations of Mizraim, was a son of Ham, that's Egypt. Phut was another, P-H-U-T, that's translated Libya in Ezekiel 38 and 39. But there they lived in North Africa. The descendants of Cush, another son of Ham, mostly moved into the Horn of Africa, into Ethiopia, Sudan, and most of them then moved into Asia, Afghanistan, Pakistan, and part of India. The name of Kush is still on the world map today in Afghanistan and Pakistan, as the Hindu Kush Mountains straddle Afghanistan and Pakistan. Kush, by the way, is named as going to be an ally of Russia and China in the war against Israel in the latter days. So Pakistan is becoming more and more anti-American. I have not a clue why we're fighting the Taliban for rocks in Afghanistan, where we have no strategic purpose, and there's no, or we're just wearing out our soldiers and our equipment.
We're fighting in Afghanistan for the poppies, and the CIA's bringing them back and making a killing off that.
Well, I've read that on the internet. I've also read that they think that there's rare earths that global corporations want, or they want to build a pipeline from the Caspian region of oil down to the Indian Ocean. But those are all pipe dreams. I mean, the soldiers are dying for Babylon the Great's global corporations. They're not dying for any American interest. To answer your question again, Ham also had a son. There was a Canaan, and the Canaanites were, you know, they were originally in the Promised Land. That was called the Land of Canaan. And the Canaanites and more Hamite people migrated into Africa, and they became the black nations. The Asians were more the Orientals, were Japheth, and Shem was in the Fertile Crescent and in Europe and the Mediterranean world. And
here's my question. Where did the black DNA come into the picture, though?
Well, all of our DNA came from Noah's family. The Bible says we're all one blood, but here's the difference.
There wasn't a black person in Noah's family.
Well, the Bible doesn't say that. You know, keep in mind, Noah and his wife were, we know they were, it says Noah was perfect in his generations. They were, you know, a matched couple. And the three sons that came would have been direct products of Noah and his wife's DNA. However, the Bible doesn't tell us what the races were of Shem, Ham, and Japheth's wife, since the Semites from Shem became largely what we call the Caucasian or white races. It's logical that he had a white wife, since Japheth, his descendants became the Oriental nations. It's logical that his wife was more an Oriental wife. It was also logical that Ham, since his descendants turned into the black nations, that he had a black wife. And really, in Mother Eve's eggs, the potential for all the races was there. I mean, God really doesn't, God is, you know, all Jesus Christ is an equal opportunity Savior for all nations. There is no racial supremacy in any of my books or messages, and I reject any of those kind of attitudes. In the Bible, it clearly shows that all of our nations have descended from there. But when they first walked off the ark, the racial differences might have been very minor at that point. However, remember that God changed all of the languages at Babel, and there he divided the nations according to their languages. So he gave each language group a particular language. So everybody had to migrate according to their own language group. And when you have a breeding population that breeds only within itself, it's going to bring out strongly the internal genetic traits of that particular nation. And so the Oriental nations became steadily more Oriental. The nations from Ham became ever blacker and took on more of their characteristics. The white nations from Shem took on more and more of their national and racial characteristics. And
well,
so in that regard,
I've also heard this said by several pastors in the past. It states in the Bible that Shem and Ham and Japheth came upon their father and their mother and noticed they had been drinking and they were drunk. And it says they were naked. And they took, I guess, a robe, and they walked backwards to place the robe over the father and mother. But it says that Ham uncovered his mother's nakedness. Now, some pastors said that Ham had a homosexual relationship with his father, which is not so. He had a relationship with his mother. Because all through the Bible in the Old Testament, it says that woman is man's nakedness. So we can establish that fact. Then his father told him that you would always be a servant under your brother, Japheth. I always thought perhaps at that point there was a curse put on him, and that's where the black nation come from. Because all through history, up until, you know, after the so-called, I call it the war against the states, that had changed. But until then, they were actually classified as the beast of the field.
Well, I've heard that too, and I don't think the beast of the field refers to the blacks at all. Now, what you're referring to is Genesis 9, the account in verse 20 to 29. Now, in that particular account, it doesn't say anything about Noah and Noah's wife. It only says Noah there, that he drank of the vine and was drunk and was uncovered within his tent. There's nothing about Noah's wife in that episode at all. And it says Ham, the father of Canaan, saw the nakedness of his father and told his two brothers. Well, Shem and Japheth took a garment and laid it upon their shoulders, and they went backward and covered the nakedness of their father. And that was really, they were showing respect.
Right.
And so they did see their father's nakedness, but Ham did. And so what happened there isn't specifically described in the Bible. But there is a curse that was pronounced on Canaan here. You can't help but seeing that in the Bible, but it says Canaan will be a servant to both Shem and Japheth. But now keep in mind, Canaan was only one branch of the family of Ham. Ham had many different sons. Canaan was just one. Cush, Mizraim, Phut, and the other descendants of Ham did not have that curse on them. So this was not a descendant. This was not a curse to all the descendants of Ham. It was just a curse on the one branch of the Hamitic family. I hope that answers your question in that regard. And it does imply that it says we'll be servants in to Shem or Japheth. Servants. I'd have to look at the Hebrew. I don't have that in front of me, but it could imply slavery. And certainly that is what happened over time in many different times and circumstances. But I want to get back with the hostess's permission to get back to what I think is the next big prophetic event about to happen, which was the fall of Babylon the Great. When our U.S. dollar collapses, or when it greatly weakens, and or whatever its value is, if it loses its federal reserve global currency status, we're going to be in deep trouble here. And it says when this happens, there will be a new global system, which will be the beast power. And that beast power, it says in Revelation 13, is only going to have 42 months to reign. So when we see this collapse take place and a new global world order system, a new global currency or a group of regional currencies replacing this, what we have now, when we can see the beast system start, you know, the Bible tells us that beast system is only going to last 42 months. And then the two witnesses will be doing a tremendous prophetic work for 42 months, 1,260 days, during that same time, pretty much concurrently, because at the end of the two witnesses' ministry in Revelation 11, it says they will be killed by the beast forces, and the beast will have hated them because the two witnesses will be plaguing the beast's kingdom and smiting the world with earth with plagues as often as they wish for their ministry. And so the beast is not to be envied. For 3.5 years, his hands are going to be tied by the two witnesses. And when the two witnesses are slain, they lay dead for only 3.5 days, at which a voice says, come up hither into the heavens. And whether the Christians like to call it a rapture or a taking up or whatever, that pinpoints us when the two witnesses are taken up into the heaven. And I don't think they have a private resurrection. I think that applies to all the resurrection of the deceased saints, and anyone who is alive will be changed in the twinkling of an eye, and that's when they go up. But that means the Christians who think they're going to be raptured away and, you know, have five-star hotel service in heaven and pampered by angels while they just watch what's happening on earth are in for a sad and rude awakening. They're going to be here during those 42 months of the beast's reign, you know, unless they die before. So it behooves mm-hmm. them to start making some preparations, you know, whether it's digging wells or having big gardens, planting some orchards, stocking up on things. We don't know what's coming, but there's another reason. It's not just a selfish desire to, you know, to take for the self and I'll save myself and I'll sit here with my mini Ruger 15 or street sweeper shotgun or whatever and defend my canned goods. You know, we're supposed to have an attitude of loving service to others.
Hey, Matthew, Steve, I got another question real quick in the chat room. Willie's asked it twice, so I keep forgetting. Sorry, Willie.
Yep.
He wants to know about the Jubilee writings about Enoch.
The Jubilee writings about Enoch. I'm afraid in my books and in my writings on the Ten Tribes of Israel, the book of Enoch didn't factor into that. There is a book of Jubilees, and there's a book of Enoch. I'm not sure which one he's referring to. But I'm afraid I can't respond to that because it doesn't address the topic that my books discuss.
Okay.
Nobody's an expert on everything here. And so I don't claim to be an expert on areas that I haven't researched.
No, and there's so much. I've been looking into this for a year and a half, and I still have barely scratched the surface.
But you can see that in Ezekiel 38 and 39, where it says that we're going to be meaning the nations of all the tribes of Israel and their global allies, but primarily Israel, that's the name that's on Ephraim and Manasseh, the United States and the British, the Anglo-Saxon nations that have the name of Isaac on them, we're going to be invaded out of the north. And now during the Cold War, we always knew we would be invaded if it came out of the north. You know, we had preparations with the, there was the Dew Line and the Bemuse Line, et cetera, and over the pole worries about missiles coming, et cetera. We've largely dismantled our defenses. I mean, Ezekiel 38 likens Israel in the latter days to a city without walls and without bars or gates. What that really means is that we have neglected our defenses terribly. A city that in the ancient times didn't even bother to build a big, strong wall was just a juicy target because they couldn't keep out a besieging army. I mean, we don't even protect our Mexican border. We can't even defend that border, much less anything else. Our armies are being wasted in their lives and energies and equipment hither and yon all over the world while North America is largely undefended. And we have an Achilles heel that we don't realize. But Ezekiel 38 and 39 puts its finger right on it. We can easily be attacked out of the north by Russia and China. All Russia has to do with China is seize a number of Alaskan airfields with Spetsnaz troops, seize them very quickly. They could do that with just a few bullets. And seize the oil refinery, the Alaska oil pipeline up there. They could take over the critical areas of Alaska and start a 24/7 invasion of troops with air transports and ships moving their military into Alaska, and then they just send them down through Canada to the United States and invade North America from the north. Because
well,
from Alaska,
even you know what's scary is they're already invading us without firing a shot. They're moving in here by the droves.
Well, they really are.
And we don't do anything. I mean, they're setting up free trade zones, and they're moving in here. It's really creepy. And here's the thing. China and Russia have already, like you said, they've already formed an alliance, so to speak. They're trading oil back and forth without using the U.S. dollar.
Yes, they are.
It's all lining up just like our father said that it would.
Yes, which really goes to also show, when you realize just how true the Bible is in its prophecies about Israel and the geography and the clues that would be about Israel in the latter days, only a creator God could have authored these prophecies and millennia later be bringing them to pass. You know, any other so-called holy book, the Quran or any others, does not mm-hmm. have specific prophecies like this that show control over the nations. The God who wrote the Bible is controlling an overall plan which he sits in charge of. He's sovereign in the universe, and he rules. And Isaiah 41, verses 21 to 26, there God is saying, you know, can any other God control world events like me? He says, look, he points to his ability to fulfill his prophecies as proof that he is the sovereign creator. And he also says, you can't know the latter end unless you know the former things thereof. So you have to understand the history to properly understand how the latter day events are going to unfold. My book does that. When you see world history through the Israelite point of view, not through the Greco-Roman point of view, you will see that God has been keeping his promises and prophecies about the tribes of Israel all through history, and he is just as hands-on today. He sits there, you know, at the throne of the universe, and the nations will do his bidding. We're acting out a script, and the Bible has already given us the end chapters. Mm-hmm. You know, if our nation had not forsaken God, and we knew we were Israel, we would know that we were going to be invaded out of the north by Russia and China coming down through Alaska, which, by the way, used to be a Russian province. People forget that. I think it was during Lincoln's administration that Seward, it was called Seward's Folly. People said, why do you want to buy Alaska way up there? But anyway, that used to be a Russian territory. They know it very well. Mm-hmm. And they can easily seize the airfields like there and just start sending people down. But if our nation understood that we were Israel in the Bible prophecies, and if they understood that God was in charge and he's going to do this, our witless leaders could be preparing for this invasion and taking God at his word and realizing that God's tipped us off. He's given us the enemy's invasion plan in Ezekiel 38. But we have rejected God from our nation, our culture, our schools. So we're sitting here fat, dumb, and stupid, not realizing that we're under direct threat. China, in fact, is hoping that we are going to fall into their hands like ripe fruit, that we will be just so decayed from within economically and financially that there won't even need to be a war because just collapse. Now, Ezekiel 38...
Yeah, why would they... That's the easiest way to take over a country. Just let it fall, then come in and pick up the pieces.
Exactly. In Ezekiel 38 and 39, you can see that perhaps as a foreclosure raid, because it says in Ezekiel 38 and 39, they're not coming to nuke everything. It says they're coming to take our cattle, our goods, our silver, our gold. In other words, they're coming for our agricultural productive land. They're coming for the gold and silver and hard assets, the livestock. They want to take everything we have and either kill us off or turn us into slaves. I've got a series of blogs at my website. If you go to the blog archive and type in Chinese nanotechnology weapons, you'll see that the Chinese are planning a new super weapon of mass destruction. And I'm not the only writer on this, but you'll see mine high on a Google. If you just Google that, you'll see my blogs pretty high on the list, sometimes at the top. But the Chinese are working on a nanotechnology weapon that combines the human DNA genome research with nanobot or nanotechnology weapons so they can design invisible little nanobots that can be distributed by either an airburst or water or in food. But what they would do is these little nanobots would target DNA populations and then they would kill them once they enter a host. Think of how easy it would be for China. They would have the ultimate weapon if they designed a nanotechnology weapon that could be distributed throughout the world, where it would kill every human being that did not have a certain degree of Chinese DNA. The nanobot would not activate its harmful qualities within the body of anybody who had Chinese DNA, so they would be protected and immune. Everybody else would die off, and China would inherit the earth. So that's one weapon that others have been warning about, too, but I've been putting it in a biblical context. However, Ezekiel 38 and 39 show that that isn't going to work. We're not going to fall into their hands like ripe fruit. In fact, they're going to have to invade to try to take everything they can. And here's where, just possibly, and this is speculation on my part, that the United States' Second Amendment might fit into this. Because it says in Ezekiel 38, when Israel, the land of Israel, is attacked, in verse 21, when this invasion takes place, God says, I will call for a sword against him throughout all my mountains. Mountains can be a symbol of large nations. Mm-hmm. And so that it calls on the Israelite people not to surrender. It says, use your swords, use your weapons against this invading host. And
That's right.
So it makes sense that, you know, God will make sure in his fulfillment of prophecies that the nation called Israel, that's primarily the one attacked here, the land that's the melting pot nation, has a lot of weapons for their people to grab to fight back. if we didn't have a Second Amendment, we wouldn't have any weapons to fight back with. And this prophecy says we clearly will have them. So I take heart in that, that our Second Amendment is God-given and that he will preserve that so that the hundreds of millions of guns in American hands will be used against those invaders when they come.
Well, God doesn't tell us in the Bible to be pacifist, even though your 501c3 churches want you to think that. That's not what he says. We are to be warriors. We are the Israelites. Now, I got another question for you from the chat room, Stephen.
Sure.
Are evil guys in control of the U.S. of the tribes?
Well, to put it in a simple answer, yes. I mean, as I said earlier, our finances, our dollars, is being ruled by Babylon the Great. And, multinational corporations are in bed with the leaders, the political leaders. That's prophesied in Revelation 18:3, which I described earlier, where they're ripping off all the people for their own benefit. I personally don't think we've had a pro-American president since Ronald Reagan. I think all of the presidents since then have been puppets of the globalist people that have been running Wall Street and the global multinational corporations. They've been sacrificing Main Street. They've been sacrificing America, our dollar, our heritage. They've shipped our jobs overseas for short-term corporate profit, even though that's put terrible danger to our national security.
Well, they're breaking down the walls of all of the nations because they want us to be a global people. So that, and I think it's further to try to deceive, so the Israelites don't realize who they are.
No, and in fact, that's one of the great worries I think of the enemy, is that the Israelite nations will wake up and find out who they are, because if we realize that we were the Israelite 10 tribes of Israel, and that God is real, and that his Bible can be provably shown to be precisely keeping prophecies in the latter days right before our very eyes, it could lead to national repentance. And if we have a national repentance, God would intervene, and he could change the course of history and cancel out these judgments against our nation if we repent. Just like Nineveh was told it was going to perish, but they just humbled themselves, and God canceled the penalty. The penalties and the prophesied destructions on the United States, if we repented as a nation and realized our heritage, they could be greatly either canceled out or lessened. And in Joel 2, which was a parallel prophecy to Ezekiel 38, there it says that when this invasion from the north occurs, the nations of Israel better repent. God says that let the priests and the elders and the people and everybody fast and pray and ask me to come in and intervene. And he says he's not going to until they fast and pray and ask him to intervene and rescue them. So the clear implication is that we're going to lose this war unless God intervenes on our side. And but praise him, he is going to intervene. He promises he will. But when the tipping point reaches, when the nation is crying out to God for rescue, he does intervene. But it's clearly said in Joel 2 that the people of Israel and the people that are attacked out of the north here are going to have to cry out to him for his deliverance, and then he will come and deliver.
Amen.
So
on that.
When we know this kind of an event, and I'm not putting an estimation on a year, personally, I don't think that Gog-Magog invasion is coming next week or next month. I think that's coming at the end of the 3.5 years of the beast and the two witnesses. As long as the two witnesses are on the scene, I think their power is going to be so vast, no nation will dare defy them. I think once they're dead, that's when a great persecution of the Christians breaks out, and that's when I think the Gog-Magog nations will double-cross the beast leader and attack the other nations of the West than Israel, and that's when we're going to get World War III, and it wouldn't take long with the weapons of mass destruction to break out where Christ would have to quickly come. Because he does say in Matthew 24 that except those days be shortened, there would be no flesh left alive.
That's
so
right.
this does allow for the possibility that some of these prophetic timetables might not play out. If the devil is able to accelerate the destruction of World War III or the destruction of mankind through bizarre technologies of HARP or quantum weapons or antimatter weapons, whatever, if we come to the point where they make a terrible mistake, and we're at the point of exterminating mankind, Christ will intervene to make sure that no flesh, that all, that some flesh is saved alive.
That's
so,
right.
So we need, you know, there's lots of people, and I've heard from many of them, they spend hours and hours going over all the charts, and I've done some of that too, you know, to try to reconcile these biblical time intervals to try to understand prophecy. But Christ gives himself that flexibility, and he tells us that unless those days were going to be shortened, there'd be no flesh left alive. So to everybody who thinks they've got the dates figured out, Christ is saying, you know, I'm probably going to be coming earlier than you expect, which
That's
fits
right.
the Genesis, which fits that parable of the 10 virgins, where Christ surprises all of his believers by coming a lot earlier than they expected.
Well, I have another question for you, Stephen, in the chat.
Fire away.
I got last questions. Who do you think are the witnesses? Are they two people or two countries?
Well, I think they're two people. The reason is it says when the beast makes war against them, their dead bodies will lie and they won't allow them to be buried, and they'll die in the city of Jerusalem. You can't have two whole nations come to Jerusalem and have all their bodies die and lay there. But two individuals can be there. And it says every eye will see them laying there, and then when they're resurrected, the eyes will see them. In the days of modern webcams, with live webcams, the beast power will probably have a live webcam on their bodies to proclaim to the world that they've been defeated, and then the whole world will be shocked when they're resurrected from the dead, and they go up on that live webcam up into the clouds. So I think they're going to be two people. Now, at my website, www.stephenmcollins.com, you can go to the Articles tab, and I have a very extensive article on the two witnesses, going through who they may or may not be, and I don't name names because I don't know. But the Bible does give us clues. For example, Moses and Aaron did a great deal of miracles as a twosome when they went against Egypt. Elijah and Elisha were contemporaries. Jesus Christ and John the Baptist were contemporaries.
Hey, Stephen. We're running out of time here, so let me say something real quick in case we run out of time. The
sure.
Funny Bones news, sports, and music will not be on tonight, guys, because it's moving to Sundays at 4 p.m. Central Time, and that starts this Sunday. So G-Man will not be on this third hour tonight, so he wanted me to let everybody know. Now, Stephen, you take it till the end. You've probably got a minute left. And just take it till you hear the music, and we'll have you back on. The listeners are loving you.
Well, I'd look forward to coming back. There is so much to share with people because the Bible is an incredibly relevant book. My books are non-denominational. They have appealed to people. I've heard from all different denominations that have loved it, and it's built up their faith in God and in the Bible. And more people are waking up to their Israelite heritage and who really is in charge of world events, which is God himself guiding these events. And the more people that find out about this and understand the truth that's in my books, the more likely is that we're going to get national repentance, which is really what we need. And so I urge your listeners to order that $12.99 book as a download and let their friends and relatives or Bible study or fellowship or church members know about it too. It's a very cheap price where they can see the whole history of the world from the Bible's point of view, not the pagan Greco-Roman view that we get force-fed in our schools. And So I hope they will be benefiting from it, but I have blogs on my website that follow the prophetic events, and the one that's coming out tomorrow is on financial martial law coming to U.S. states, where it talks about the Michigan legislature passing a bill here that the governor says he'll sign, where they can put a financial martial law on any city or school district or local government in Michigan and kick out the elected officials, and they will just appoint rulers without any consent of the governed to take over those cities. So the cities and states that are in dire financial shape within the United States, this may be a harbinger of what's coming. So I urge your listeners to check my website tomorrow and see this when it goes up on the blog site tomorrow to see what may be coming to all of those states that are in cities that are in dire financial debt trouble right now.
That'll be an excellent blog. Guys, read it. It's what we've been talking about and what we're preparing for. Stephen Collins, I thank you so much for being a guest tonight. I'm sorry it got off kind of a rocky start. That's my fault. I'll probably give you a buzz tomorrow, Stephen. I want to thank you for sharing your information. Everybody check out his site. I've put it up in the chat room a bunch of times. I can hear someone. Watch your sticks, everybody. And hang in there. By the grace of God, we'll be back with you next Thursday. Blessings to all. And good night.
Good night.
Good night, Stephen.